Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. American journalist Jill Carroll is in the care of U.S. officials in Baghdad. Shortly after noon today, Baghdad time, Jill Carroll was brought to the headquarters of a Sunni political party in Baghdad, where she borrowed a phone and called her family to say she was all right. Carroll was taken by gunmen calling themselves the Revenge Brigade while out on a story for the Christian Science Monitor almost 3 months ago. She said today on Iraqi television she did not know why she was taken or why she was freed. She also told an Arabic-speaking questioner that she was happy to be free, she was well-treated, and she was eager to be with her family. She said she was kept in a furnished room with a shower, but she didn't know where she was held or what was going on around her.
Here and there, I would get some news. One time, they brought me a newspaper, so I got some news from a newspaper once, but that was about it. I didn't really know what was going on.
After the interview, Tariq al-Hashimi, who's the Secretary General of the Iraqi Islamic Party, presented Carroll with some gifts, including the Quran. Now you have to listen closely.
And this is the Holy Quran.
Oh, okay. Beautiful. Thank you.
Upon which we treated like that.
Thank you.
What we have received today from Iraqi Islam Party is exactly the teachings of Islam.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
What you have received today is exactly the teachings of Islam. Well, after that, officials from the U.S. Embassy took Jill Carroll away. Amir Madhani reports from Iraq for the Chicago Tribune. Amir, you're there in Baghdad. Was there any sense that this was coming?
No, this came totally out of the blue late last night. Jill's sister, Katie, had broadcast on Al Arabiya, one of the Arabic satellite channels that's popular here, another plea. And, you know, essentially, Katie said that she was worried about Jill because there hadn't been any word at all, really, of her since February 9th. And the captors had set a deadline at the end of February for when they would kill her by if their demands were not met. And that deadline had passed. It's been about a month since that deadline, and you know, she sounded very concerned. And but no, this was a great surprise for everybody that she's all right and she's going to be going home.
A delightful surprise, I'm sure. But we have been following other news from Baghdad. Other kidnapping cells have been broken up. There was the release last week of the three Christians who had been held who had been kidnapped. We understand there was an Iraqi woman who had been released from her kidnappers, and her mother actually mentioned Jill Carroll. So is there a sense that these kidnapping groups are being broken up or not?
Well, I guess that's hard to say. I think they've had a good run lately. There was the Christian peacemakers, the three of them that were released last week. And then earlier this week, there was an incident that caused some controversy near Sadr City when a Husseinia was raided by Iraqi forces, aided by American special forces, in which they freed a man that had been kidnapped the day before, and a bounty of $20,000 was put on this unfortunate man's head. And now this Jill Carroll situation, where, you know, her captors, for whatever reason, decided that it was time to let her go. So it has been a good run, but Jill Carroll has become this huge figure and has gotten a lot of notoriety, but there's hundreds of Iraqis that have been kidnapped and dozens of Americans, and these good stories are unfortunately few and far between.
Well, let's find out more about what it might mean. As we said, she was released to the Iraqi Islamic Party. She was taken first to a branch office of the party and then transported by armed convoy of the party to the party's headquarters in another part of Baghdad. Tell us more about the Iraqi Islamic Party and what it means that they received her.
They're a trusted group. It's a moderate Sunni political party that did fairly well as far as within sort of the Sunni parties in the last election. Their leaders are trusted by both people within the Sunni community, and they're well respected by people within the American diplomatic community as well.
Well, and Jill Carroll was on her way to interview a Sunni politician when she was taken in early January. That politician, Adnan al-Dulaimi, didn't show up, and her car was attacked, her translator killed. And there was some speculation at the time that the Sunni politician had been somewhat complicit in her kidnapping. So is there an attempt by this group to erase that?
Well, Adnan Dulaimi is from a different Sunni party. I spoke with Mr. Dulaimi earlier today, and he was overjoyed. He said that Jill had been released, but he also said that he hoped that this proved that he wasn't involved with this. He has been, since her capture, he has repeatedly spoken in public and asked whoever was holding her that she should be let go. But these are two different parties, the party that she was dropped off to and the politician whose offices she was going to or leaving from at the time of her abduction.
Right. And the party that received her had a camera there to record her arrival. They gave, as we said, they gave her a plaque and the Quran. And the party also said unknown people had dropped her off. So your sense of this, you're there in Baghdad. Is this something that's playing over and over on television? Is this an effort on the part of the party to show another side than what people are seeing, as you said, about these horrible kidnapping stories? What's your sense of how it was positioned?
That's good news, and this is, this the television station that broadcasted the interview with Jill is the party's television station. It's called Baghdad TV. And yeah, it was a great opportunity to sort of show some good news and how they were treating Jill well, and how they'd been entrusted with her and how they were going to make sure that she was handed over to the Americans and in good shape. This is huge news in Iraq. She's, her name has sort of become part of the Iraqi lexicon. She's become this figure, and the political parties and the various television stations have worked with the Christian Science Monitor to get her face on TV and to keep it out there that she, in the last month and a half or so, that she's still out there and that she needs to be found. Mm-hmm. And, the various media was working really hard to help her release. The various media I'm speaking of is the Iraqi media, particularly.
Did you know Jill Carroll?
I did. We were friends, not real good friends. Like, I had last seen her on Christmas night. I'd had dinner with her and some other correspondents at the Washington Post house that's in this compound that we all live in, or many of the Western journalists live in.
Yeah. So, I mean, obviously you've got to have some personal relief.
Oh yeah, it's wonderful to see that she's okay. I'm still hopeful for her and the path that she has ahead of her, and sort of coming to terms with this. I can't even imagine what she went through, and what she still has ahead of her. Mm-hmm. And I just hope that everything can turn out for her the best as possible. She's an incredible journalist, and she really cares about the story. I think what we often forget is that in the Jill Carroll story was that her translator Alan was brutally murdered right in front of her face.
A 29-year-old,
somebody that was just about the same age as she was, mm-hmm. with children in his life.
Oh, we lost the line with Amir Madhani. He was speaking to us from Baghdad. He's with the Chicago Tribune and reminding us that Alan Anwia, the 29-year-old friend and translator of Jill Carroll, was killed in the ambush in which she was kidnapped. Well, we want to spend a couple of minutes now with Monica Brady Meyeroff of Here and Now and of Here in Boston. And Monica, you were at the news conference today at the Christian Science Monitor's headquarters here. Jill Carroll, of course, reporting for them. A great sense of relief and a lot of tears there.
Yes, everyone was thrilled. Everyone was hugging each other. The editor of the paper, Richard Bergenheim, thanked everyone who worked for her release. He said the paper wasn't involved in any negotiations for her release. In fact, he didn't know of any negotiations for her return. And he said there was no ransom paid, and he said there was no evidence the U.S. military was involved. So a lot of details are still unclear. Bergenheim did credit an outcry from Muslim leaders who called for her to be freed.
The chorus of Muslim leaders condemning this kidnapping has been larger and louder than has been heard for some time. We earnestly hope that these voices of opposition to this crime will continue on behalf of all hostage victims until this practice stops.
And as we just heard, many hostage victims, Iraqis among them. So the Christian Science Monitor not involved in any negotiations, but they did keep the story alive.
Yes, they did. As the speaker before me just said, her name became a lexicon in Iraq. I mean, they had almost daily updates on their website about her condition or what they knew about her. And they also launched a campaign for public service announcements on Iraqi television. They started this in February, and just 2 months of her release, they were broadcasting on Iraqi television things that said, Jill Carroll loves Iraq and now she needs your help. It's time for Jill Carroll to come home safely. So they really kept her image and her plight alive among Iraqis as well as in the United States.
Well, her father told reporters today he was thankful that the Monitor did so much. And we just want to comment that she had many other ties to Massachusetts.
Yes, she did. She went to UMass Amherst, and there, one of her professors said, their hearts are lighter. They're very happy that she's been safely returned.
Monica Brady Meyerhoff, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
And now we turn to another journalist who knows what it's like to be in Jill Carroll's position. Micah Guerin and his translator Amir were held for 10 days in the summer of 2004 after they were kidnapped, and he was released and joins us from New York. And Micah, you've got to be thrilled with the news today.
Oh, yeah, it was amazing. It was an incredible thing to wake up to. I just woke up with my email and was delighted to see she'd been free.
Yeah. Well, and help us understand what might be happening now, both, you know, I mean, you'd only speculate what's going on in her mind. I can only imagine the release of tension she must be feeling.
Yeah, I mean, you know, as soon as you actually know you're free, which is pretty much, you know, I don't know how it happened with her precisely, but in my case, it was, you know, they told us to lift off our blindfold, and they said, you are free. You know, it's a wave of euphoria, and quickly followed by a lot of confusion. You know, in her case, I saw she was in front of a press conference, and that's what happened to me as well. I was immediately let free in a press conference. And sort of the last thing you want to do is answer questions, because you're still trying to figure out, you know, trying to put it into perspective what happened to you, you know, how you got there. And, you know, it's just it's one of those things that takes a long time to begin to sort of settle in and pick up the pieces.
And then, Micah, what happens as far as, I mean, we only have about a minute left, and I want to know what happens as far as the U.S. military? Will she be questioned now, or what happens then?
Well, you know, typically you are debriefed for, you know, a short period, just, you know, to and mostly to see how she's doing, if she's, you know, psychologically well, if she's physically well, and then, you know, immediately you're sent back and reunited with your family. They're very conscious.
And something tells me that she will be making a campaign for the other Iraqis who are still held hostage all over the country. Micah Guerin, filmmaker and journalist, who was himself a hostage once. He's written a book about it called American Hostage. Micah, thanks as always for weighing in with us on this important day.
Thank you.
Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's here and now. President Bush is in Cancun, Mexico today for a two-day summit with the leaders of Mexico and Canada. The president started the day by touring nearby Mayan ruins before diving into talks on trade disputes, the war on terror, and immigration. The president's visit comes as the U.S. Senate is debating how to deal with the estimated 11 million illegal immigrants in the U.S. Some lawmakers want to build a 700-mile fence on the U.S.-Mexico border and make it a felony to be in the U.S. illegally. Others want to create a guest worker program for hundreds of thousands of foreigners and set undocumented workers on the path to citizenship after they pay fines, pass criminal background checks, and learn English. President Bush is pushing Mexico to help secure the 2,000-mile border between the two countries. President Fox wants some form of legal status for all illegal immigrants, but says the guest worker program is a good first step. Well, how do other Mexicans view the immigrant issue? For one view, we call Nogales Juarez, Sonora, Mexico. It's the fourth largest border town on the U.S.-Mexican border. It's about 70 miles due south of Tucson, Arizona. Kiko Trujillo works with people who've come to Nogales in the hopes of entering the U.S. and often find themselves living in squatter villages that have sprung up around the city. And Kiko joins us now. Welcome.
Thank you, Robin.
And first of all, can you tell us a little more about your city? You know, how big is it and how much of the population is, you know, people passing through to the U.S. border?
Nogales is a town that was founded in the mid-1880s. And by 1970, Nogales had no more than 30,000 people living in here. That's when most of the maquiladoras under the maquiladora program came to Nogales. And that made the city, that together with the migration of people from farming communities in the south, made Nogales grow from 30,000 to almost 400,000 today in a span of a little bit more than 30 years.
And tell us, maquiladoras, these are the factories?
These are foreign-owned factories operating in Mexico under a special set of rules. In other words, they don't pay any taxes, or they pay very little taxes and are taking advantage of the low labor cost here on the border. And the city of Nogales obviously grew so fast. In fact, at one point, we were the fastest-growing city in the entire Mexican Republic. So the city obviously could not keep up with the growth pace. And so you have the result of that is a great number of squatter colonies on the outskirts of Nogales that have no water, no electricity in some cases, people living in areas where they're just living under a tree covered with a blanket, or houses made of pallet racks or wood and cardboard. So almost 60% of them came to Nogales with the idea of going into the United States. By the time they got to Nogales, they had run out of money or they had been robbed. And the only option they had is to go and find a job in these factories. This is the good side about these factories, that they're always offering jobs. So many of them came to Nogales. They found out that there were jobs available, and they decided to stay here.
Well, and I was going to say, so how do you feel about the debate over immigration policy?
Well, I am not going to waste my life in trying to fix problems on the U.S. side. I'm going to focus, as a Mexican, more on what President Fox, my administration, is doing in Mexico. And I don't think my administration has done anything about that other than just try to put all the blame in the United States and say, oh, they got to fix it. They got to come up with reforms in their immigration laws. And what about reforms in Mexico on the economic situation that is causing all these people to migrate to the north?
Well, Kiko, are you saying that it's just a matter of jobs? I mean, it sounds as if you are.
No, I don't think it's just a matter of jobs. It's a matter of jobs that are well-paid, that they make enough money to provide for their families. Yeah. I was just talking about maquiladoras, and you know, the average salary in these factories is $7 a day. It's impossible with the cost of living in Mexico to support a family of four making $7 a day.
And yet you make the point that many of these Mexicans and others from, you know, Latin and South America are taking the $7 a day job, even though it's not enough. Well, there are many people here in the U.S. who believe that NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, has been bad for American workers because U.S. companies do outsource work to these cheaper Mexican factories. But you're saying that NAFTA has also been devastating for Mexicans. How so?
Absolutely. We're getting flooded with all these subsidized products from the United States, agricultural products, when Mexico should be growing its own products. The problem is that the Mexican government, while NAFTA was being implemented, was taking away the subsidies to the farmers, while in the United States they were being increased.
And Kiko, to make sure I've heard you, you say the one thing that would stop people from going is better jobs in Mexico.
Yes, jobs that dignify people, that offer a decent salary, better health conditions, better hospitals, things like that that are going to hold the people.
What about just the thinking, you say better jobs in Mexico will keep them from crossing the border, but there are a lot of business people in Mexico who would say that would be a problem for the U.S. economy.
Well, tough. You know, we all have to look for ways to survive as a country. And to me, the best solution is for both countries to sit on a table and renegotiate NAFTA and set them up in a way that both countries benefit from it and avoid this migration for economic reasons. Mexico is able to produce a lot of things, but right now, all these businesses that are coming from the United States, you know, all these big names, the Walmarts, the Sam's Clubs, the Burger Kings, the McDonald's, they're all importing products from the United States. All we're doing here is buying the hamburgers, and they're making a profit.
You want Mexico to export something other than house cleaners in Los Angeles.
Absolutely. And there is absolutely no reason why Mexico cannot do that. If there hadn't been corruption in our government while President Salinas was negotiating NAFTA, we would not have had this problem.
Kiko Trujillo, speaking to us from Nogales, Mexico. I just want to ask you before we let you go, one of the ideas being debated in Congress is building more walls along the U.S.-Mexico border. We understand there is a wall right now separating Nogales from the U.S. where there used to be a chain-link fence. How do people there feel about the possibility of more walls going up?
Listen, I'm a native of Nogales, Sonora. I've lived here all my life, and I'm used to that wall. I don't mind. The problem is that they think that with a wall or a double wall or a triple wall, they're going to hold these people from coming into the United States. They're not. The need is so bad that it's only going to make things worse. It's going to make the border more unsafe. The price of going into the United States by these smugglers is going to go up. You can build as many walls as you want, but that's not going to stop the people from going into the United States. They'll find a way.
Kiko Trujillo of Nogales, Mexico, a border town about 70 miles south of Tucson, Arizona. Kiko, thanks for speaking with us.
It was a pleasure.
And again, President Bush is visiting with Mexican President Vicente Fox today in Mexico. Stay with us, much more ahead, including actress Amy Irving is coming up here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's here and now. The Los Angeles Times is reporting a blockbuster story this week about the dangers of an industrial solvent that may have contaminated millions of Americans and played a part in thousands of birth defects and cancers in the U.S. every year, and may particularly affect military bases. The newspaper, in a two-part series, reports that in the late 1990s, the Environmental Protection Agency began studying TCE, or trichloroethylene, after finding massive underground plumes of it in the nation's water. The agency then concluded that TCE was as much as 40 times more likely than previously thought to cause cancer. But starting in 2001, the Defense Department succeeded in indefinitely delaying any new standards to limit public exposure to TCE. Joining us on the line is Ralph Verbatian. He's staff writer for the Los Angeles Times. He wrote the articles. Welcome.
Thank you, Robin.
And you write that TCE is the most widespread water contaminant in the nation, and many people may recall the book and movie A Civil Action. It involved the TCE contamination of the Massachusetts town of Woburn. But what's the connection with the Defense Department? How was TCE used on military bases?
Well, TCE was used on many military bases, particularly those that used aircraft to take grease and oil off metal parts during servicing. The industrial practices until the 1970s was to put the TCE into unlined disposal pits where it would soak into the ground.
Right. And TCE was also commonly used in commercial spot cleaners. But the dumping in the ground, is that the largest way that the public was exposed to it? Because it, of course, got into the nation's water system.
Yes.
And you've talked with a BU epidemiologist who likened TCE to a World Trade Center in slow motion. What did he mean by that?
Well, there's an awful lot of cancer that occurs in our society. And if TCE does increase the risk of cancer, it would be very difficult to pick out of the millions of people who get cancer.
Well, what's the preponderance of scientific evidence that TCE, through the nation's water system, is causing cancer?
Well, the Environmental Protection Agency began studying TCE or re-examining TCE in the mid-1990s. In 2001, the EPA issued this report that found it was anywhere from 2 to 40 times more likely to cause cancer than the agency had previously believed. And that meant that the current water standards for TCE, which is 5 parts per billion, could very well be reevaluated. And there was a chance down the road that the EPA might lower that.
And the result of that would be that industry and perhaps the military would have to do very expensive cleanup of the water.
It would have driven up cleanup costs significantly because TCE exists at about half of the nation's Superfund sites and hundreds of additional contamination sites that aren't on the Superfund list.
Well, the Defense Department response, as you write to the EPA report, was to challenge it and pretty much campaign against it.
That's correct.
On what basis?
The military said that the EPA had misrepresented the data or that they had very little evidence for some of their key findings. And DOD went to some great lengths to hire consultants and experts of its own that could challenge the EPA. And they began to push very hard on that issue. And EPA, recognizing it had a major controversy on its hands, convened a scientific advisory board of outside experts to weigh all of this evidence and see whether the 2001 risk assessment came to proper conclusions or not.
Well, what does the Department of Defense say about the characterization of, you know, that they're waging a campaign against the EPA's conclusions?
Well, the DOD says it has every right under the law to challenge the EPA if they believe the EPA's scientific research is not sound, and that's exactly what they've done. DOD officials say they're all for getting the evidence on the table.
You note in your report that the Defense Department has switched tactics in this way, and that in the past they used to say that they couldn't afford to pay for things like cleanups because they had to pay for the nation's defense. And now they're going after the science.
That's right. That's a shift that's occurred among all polluters. At one time, the argument was made, well, we're going to spend hundreds of millions of dollars or billions of dollars, and we're only going to save a few lives. And polluters quickly realized that that didn't go over too well with the public, because the public was concerned that those few lives might be their own or their own families. So that pretty much was a discredited argument.
Well, we pointed out that the Defense Department would have to pay more to clean up water if the EPA findings are held. And not only that, there are a lot of families that sounds like would have legitimate lawsuits that live around these bases. You visited some of them, and they claim their cancers are the result of living outside of bases. But what's next in the story? You say the National Academy of Sciences has been tasked with studying the issue. Do you expect them to resolve this?
That's the idea. I think the National Academy will come out with a report sometime this summer, which will then be sent back to EPA. And any new regulations could take years. So really this process is not going to be resolved anytime soon, probably not before 2010.
Ralph Artabedian, a staff writer for the Los Angeles Times. And this note, the NSA secret wiretapping program, the role of Karl Rove in the White House, and Dick Cheney's recent hunting accident, they all made good fodder for Vice President Cheney, as he lampooned himself at the annual Radio and Television Correspondents Association dinner in Washington last night. Cheney was sitting in for President Bush, who was on his way to Mexico. The vice president started by saying he agreed to speak at the dinner because he thought only correspondents from Fox News would be on hand. A recent document revealed that Cheney requests that all TVs be tuned to Fox when he travels. He went on to poke fun at himself for his recent hunting mishap, where he accidentally shot his friend, Harry Whittington.
Actually, I'm feeling pretty comfortable up here. The lighting could be better. I can still see the whites of your eyes.
Guns were a theme. Cheney also ran a slideshow. He described how he gets ready for the press corps with a photo of himself aiming a high-powered rifle with a scope. He also made references to the NSA secret wiretapping program.
Of course, I'm a busy man, and I can't be expected to listen in on all of your private conversations. Sometimes I just review the transcripts with a little help from my senior advisor for wiretapping.
That laughter in response to a slide of Henry Kissinger. Guess you had to be there. You're listening to Here and Now. Well, this coming weekend is the big one in college basketball. The men's Final Four will be played in Indianapolis beginning Saturday. The women's Final Four takes the stage right here in Boston on Sunday. And joining us in the studio is the man who has been our bracket watcher, only a game host, Bill Littlefield. You watched our brackets empty.
And watched mine crumble into dust. But I don't know why you keep asking me back, but I'm delighted to be here.
Because we enjoy your company. Let's start with the men. Of course, everyone talking about George Mason University, the one team no one thought would get into the Final Four. At one point, they were 500-1 even to make it to this weekend. So do they have a chance?
When you beat the number one seed, you have a chance. One of two things can happen after you've done that as the number 11 seed. One, you can wake up and say, what are we doing here, and fumble your way to defeat. Or you can keep playing the way George Mason has been playing so far, which is, hey, we're having a great time. We're playing with the house's money. We got nothing to lose. Everybody else better look out. And sure, what the heck?
Well, they're going to meet Florida in the semifinal on Saturday. The Florida team has as its center and star the son of tennis player Yannick Noah and a former Miss Sweden. Apparently his first name is pronounced all sorts of ways. I've pronounced it wrong. His Florida sports officials say it's Joakim. His coaches call him Joakim, Joakim, Joakim. Anyway.
Frenchie, I've heard as well.
Joakim Noah seems to be a key to their chances.
Yeah, this is a fascinating kid. After pretty nondescript performances during his freshman year, he really has exploded as a sophomore. And during the tournament, he played well enough to be the Minneapolis regional most outstanding player. He's averaging over 17 points and 10 rebounds. He even steals the ball every once in a while. The guy's 6'11", so that's quite an accomplishment to reach down far enough to steal it. He really is one of those kids who apparently something in his makeup enables him to really explode onto the scene at that point where everybody's watching.
Right, and it's so he's a lot of fun to watch. He plays air guitar.
Absolutely.
He's a good time.
Bob Marley is his hero, and he's having a wonderful time and has picked a great time to have it.
Okay, so we'll look for him. In the other men's semifinal game, UCLA will meet Louisiana State University. Louisiana has teams in both the men's and women's Final Four, which has got to be a great morale booster for the state that's still, reeling from Hurricane Katrina.
I hope so, and I love the stories involving LSU. Simone Augustus, the player of the year last year on the women's side and the nation's leading scorer on the women's side, says that she's been sending messages back and forth to the men's team. So we made it to the Elite Eight. Now it's your turn. Okay, we made it to the Final Four. Now you guys pick up the piece. And so that's kind of fun. That's nice to see that sort of support. And great teams on both sides, both great fun to watch.
Right. Well, let's look at the women's Final Four. As we said, comes to Boston this week. We're excited. North Carolina meets Maryland. Duke takes on LSU this Sunday. Is it unusual for me to ask this? Because, what do I know? But, Connecticut and Tennessee aren't there. I mean, how much of a shocker is that?
Well, it is a shocker. It hasn't happened in something like 17 years. Either one or the other or both have been in the Final Four every year since 1999. But the message, I think, that this sends is that you can no longer deny that women's basketball is just getting stronger across the board. There are more and more teams with better and better programs, so fans of Connecticut and fans of Tennessee simply can't assume that the road will open up to the Final Four for those teams every year.
I guess as you said when we first started out with all of this, that's the good news.
That is decidedly the good news.
And three out of the four teams come from the Atlantic Coast Conference.
That's a first. That's a first. Never had three out of four from the same conference. So that's an exciting situation for them, especially. The payoff will be significant.
Well, the North Carolina women were number one in the final AP poll. So what does that mean, do you think, in the final analysis?
As far as I'm concerned, North Carolina has Ivory Latta, and that is every reason to root for North Carolina. This kid is 5'6". She's been pictured on every newspaper in the country doing her bicep flex pose. She's beautiful, 5'6", and she compares herself to LeBron James, whom she met at a high school tournament. I don't quite know how you root against her.
Okay, well, we're rooting for all of them because it's just so much fun to watch the college play. Bill, thanks so much.
Thank you, Robin.
Bill Littlefield. We'll be covering both Final Fours and a whole lot more from the world of sports on his show, Only a Game, this weekend. Don't miss it. Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. In her 1956 poem, Questions of Travel, Elizabeth Bishop asks, should we have stayed at home, wherever that may be? Feelings of displacement characterize the Pulitzer Prize-winning poet's work. Bishop made her home in Boston, Canada, New York, and Brazil during her lifetime. A new play, A Safe Harbor for Elizabeth Bishop, lands her mostly in Brazil, where she lived for 15 years with her lover, the influential female architect Lata de Macedo Soares. The one-woman show features Oscar nominee and Obie Award winner Amy Irving as Elizabeth Bishop.
For someone who just got here a year ago, I am adapting rather well. With all my boarding school discipline to live in a country that doesn't know what season it is, what day of the week it is, not even what time it is, I owe all the success to Lata. She makes me feel like everything is just fine, that there are no problems at all. And if one arises, she will call somebody very important and fix it in seconds.
A Safe Harbor for Elizabeth Bishop opens tonight in New York, and Amy Irving joins us from Carnegie Hall Studios in New York City. Welcome.
Thank you.
Stage. I mean, we know you in film since your breakthrough role in Carrie at 22. But, of course, you've been in theater, and you call yourself a theater brat. What drew you to this role?
Well, this has been a long time coming. I mean, I was married to a Brazilian and have spent time for the last 15 years as a part of the Brazilian culture. And my life parallels Elizabeth Bishop's quite a lot in that we both had that same time, that same love of a Brazilian and love of the Brazilian culture, and it changed both of our lives. And I think I became very aware of her while I was down there because this play began there about 4 or 5 years ago and was very celebrated, and about 4 people sent me a copy of it in Portuguese, and I fell in love with it. Another Brazilian friend had given me her letters, a book called One Art. And then while I was reading that, I happened to be a volunteer at my son Max's high school when he was still in high school, and it was the book sale, and I saw a collection of Elizabeth Bishop's poems, and I bought it and started becoming a big fan of hers. I think her poetry is gorgeous.
For those who don't know Elizabeth Bishop, what was it about her poetry? What resonated with you?
My personal resonance with her was because she wrote so much about Brazil, and having fallen in love with the culture and to have someone describe what I have seen the way Elizabeth describes it, it just spoke to me. And like the opening of one poem is, there are too many waterfalls here. I mean, you look at the place and you see these amazing mountains, because Brazil is just so gorgeous with mountains, and you can really see these like streaks along the side that aren't quite waterfalls yet, but as she said, in an age or so they probably will be. And just the sides of mountains shining at you with these waterfalls is one of the most spectacular sights you'll ever see.
Well, she ended up in Brazil because she took ill on a trip and was left behind in Brazil, where Lata took care of her.
She actually was on a tour around South America, and she just stopped in Brazil to visit some acquaintances and tasted the fruit of the cashew and had an allergic reaction and ended up in a Rio hospital. And during her convalescence, she and Lata fell in love.
Well, we have a scene from the play. Let's listen.
I can't live without Lata. I don't want to be a moment out of her sight. It's your fault, you know, Lata. You seduced me. You did. You stared at me so blatantly, no subtlety at all. I wanted to say, Lata, people are watching, disguise it a little.
There was a fairy tale aspect and intensity to, you know, the two women's romance. And it went on for several years. But what happened? How did it sour?
Elizabeth arrived very damaged. She was an alcoholic. She was orphaned very young. She was raised by aunts and grandparents and kind of never found a home. And I think she finally found a home in Brazil. She finally found her family in Lata and the people surrounding her there. And that's where she finally felt safe enough to deal with certain painful memories from the past. And then Lata got this job. Carlos Lacerda, when he became the governor, gave her the job of overseeing the Flamengo Park project, which was where they took filled in a landfill in Rio to build a park with, you know, everything from cafes and trails. I mean, we talk about this in the play, but because Lata was a woman, because Lata really didn't have architectural credentials, there was a lot of resistance, and she ended up having a breakdown during this time. And during that time, Elizabeth felt neglected. She'd had her all to herself, and you know, they were separated more, and it became very tumultuous and very dramatic. And I mean, they had a passion, but it just started to get to another level.
And Elizabeth Bishop eventually leaves Lotta, goes first to Seattle, then New York. Mm-hmm. Lotta overdoses on Valium.
She arrives in New York, and that night she takes Valium, probably very angry at Elizabeth. I don't know.
Well, we have a scene where you, as Elizabeth, talk about seeing Lotta and speaking with her for the last time. Let's listen.
She stared at me in the most horrible way, and all she could whisper was 10. Maybe telling me how many pills she had taken. That was the last thing she said before she went into a coma. At the hospital, there was hope. They kept saying that she was reacting well, but then her heart gave out.
Things got very ugly because as a lesbian couple, it's not always easy to deal with the will at the end, and the family didn't want her to have anything, and the friends all turned against her because they thought that because they broke up that was the reason that Lotta killed herself. And Elizabeth had bought a home of her own in Oro Preto, which is a beautiful Baroque city near a mining area. And she would still go back there, but she lost a lot of her friends and a lot of the connections weren't there. I actually slept in Elizabeth Bishop's bed in Oro Preto.
And how did that feel?
It felt fantastic. I've been having all sorts of mystical experiences with Elizabeth. When I was at the house, the room across from Elizabeth, and it's kept exactly how she lived there. It's a very close friend of hers that owns the house. And while I was there, across the hall was a spare bedroom, and there's a plaque on the wall. And it says something like, you know, Jesse, somebody or other, was conceived and born in this room. Cut to 4 weeks later, I'm at home in New York, and a friend brings by a new roommate for me to meet. And it was Jesse. It was the boy who was conceived and born in Bishop's house. It was like for me a sign that I was on the right road and that I was allowed to do this and have the privilege of telling the story of Elizabeth's life.
She died in 1979. How would you, sum up her life? I mean, is she a tragic character, a survivor? And what's the part that pulls you?
I think she's a survivor. I think, you know, she had a whole lot of hurdles to overcome. She, before she arrived in Brazil, she told Robert Lowell that when she dies, she wants it put on her tombstone that here lies the loneliest person that ever lived. Mm-hmm. So this is a woman who felt very isolated and found something in Brazil that made her feel whole. And I think by the time she came back, even with the pain of the loss of Lotta, she was still able to continue to love and have full relationships and a life. And I think by the end, I'd call her a survivor.
Amy Irving stars in Primary Stage's production of A Safe Harbor for Elizabeth Bishop. It opens in New York tonight. And by the way, for lovers of the poetry of Elizabeth Bishop, our friend Lloyd Schwartz tells us there's a new collection of her work, Edgar Allan Poe and the Jukebox, Uncollected Poems, Drafts, and Fragments. And for those in the Boston area, there's going to be a reading. For more information, go to our website, here-now.org.
Desilusão, danço eu, dança você, na dança da solidão.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Have a nice day and join us again, Here and Now.
Na dança da solidão. Camélia ficou viúva, Joana se apaixonou. Maria tentou a morte.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.